You are listening to the Regent College Podcast.
Hi, I'm Christina Zacharias Adji.
And I'm Claire Perini.
And welcome to the Regent College Podcast.
Friends, today we're having a conversation with Dr. George Yancey, who's a professor of sociology at Baylor University. He's published numerous articles and books on a wide range of topics, including institutional racial diversity, racial identity, academic bias, and anti-Christian hostility. And his most recent book is called Beyond Racial Division, a unifying alternative to colorblindness and anti-racism. We're so excited to have had Dr. Yancey here with us this week as part of this year's Lang Lectures at Regent, and he's speaking on Christian racial reconciliation. So, Dr. Yancey, welcome to the Regent podcast.
Thanks for having me.
We're so glad to have you at Regent and particularly on the podcast. So, yes. thanks for being with us.
Mm-hmm.
So, you've written a lot, as we've said, on race, articles and books, but it seems this most recent book, so Beyond Racial Division, a unifying alternative to colorblindness and anti-racism, is a response to something specific. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the book? How did it come about? Why did you write it?
So I think the response is to what a lot of people were responding to in 2020. If they were responding to COVID, they're responding to George Floyd. And so the book is a response to that. Now, I had written quite a bit before then, but it was like 10 or 12 years old. I think my latest book on race before then was, I think, a 2010 book with Michael Emerson. So I really stopped writing about racial issues. I mean, I spoke about it, but I didn't write about it. The George Floyd and Albury as well, that sort of, I don't know, that reached a certain tipping point for me. And also, I noticed that some of my previous work was getting more attention. And so I was thinking, well, do I really need to, does God want me to go into this space again? And I was thinking, well, no, because I don't want to, work and do that. You know, it's a lot of work to put these books together. So, but my wife was telling me, well, I think God wants you to do that. I think you should do that. And I was telling you know how much work this is? I don't want to do that. So we had a marital disagreement.
Wow.
She wanted me to write. I didn't want to write. And so we compromised. And so I wrote the book.
Great compromise.
So you had to do all the work.
Well, I mean, she actually read through. She actually read through some of the book, some of the book, and gave me advice. And you know, she, before we started having kids, she was a high school English teacher. And so, as far as writing, she knows how to write. So I really value her insight and input into this. So that's sort of what brought this on.
When you say it was a tipping, the George Floyd and Albury was a tipping point. I'm assuming you mean personally, but do you mean academically and personally, or one more than the other, or both? Or
well, I think for me it was a personal tipping point. I think it was a tipping point in the United States as well. You know, you saw from all from the reaction, and even around the world, there was a tipping point. I mean, I'm talking to people in Canada, say, well, that was a big event for us as well. So, and I think it also impacted me personally in that because of all the tension I was bringing, there are people who are looking at some of my old work and going, whoa, this could be a Christian approach. And so that sort of also brought to my mind, well, maybe this is something I need to go back into.
Thanks.
So before we want to talk about the Christian approach that you propose in your book. But before that, you say that when faced with the question of racial division, people often propose either colorblindness or anti-racism as solutions. So before we begin explaining those, can you define colorblindness and anti-racism? What do we mean when we say these terms? And is there a difference between the academic, you know, sociological definitions versus the popular ones?
Now, I don't know how the conversation is going on in Canada, but in the United States, there was this conversation. And at first, after George Floyd, what we call anti-racism really flourished up. And then a year or two afterwards, you saw sort of the pushback from colorblindness. So I'll just go ahead and I guess I'll work with anti-racism first. When you read the pop books on anti-racism that they're out there, there is a couple of, was about three or four major themes that was true. In all, there are some differences, but there are three or four major themes. That racism was epidemic, you know, throughout all our society. That that we need social change. That we have to change our whole society, and that we have to be very proactive in dealing with racism. We can't mm-hmm. just wait for, you know, hope that's going to go away. Mm-hmm. And then the last tenet, which I found in all the books, was that the role of whites was to do what people of color want them to do.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And I think that was very clear in the books. And you know, I've said, if I'm wrong, then challenge me. Mm-hmm. You know, show me a book where that's not either explicitly or implicitly implied. And no one's done that yet. So those are the tenets of anti-racism. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, there was a lot of money put towards it. You know, companies are coming out and saying, hey, we're anti-racist. And there was a huge push. And these are some of the ideas that were behind that. Mm-hmm. Having read the academic literature on anti-racism, I think that it's pretty representative. There's a couple of minor differences that I maybe quibble over. I think a lot of the anti-racism stuff in the United States focused a lot more of the United States, whereas some of the more academic stuff focused more around the world and really ties more to colonialism mm-hmm. a bit yep. more than what yeah. we saw in the United States. But those are quibbles. I mm-hmm. mean, the basic ideas were the same. Colorblindness is easier to explain. It's just that we ignore race. Mm-hmm. That the way we deal with racism, we ignore race. If I don't see your race, then I won't treat you differently because of your race, and therefore we have the equality in mm-hmm. that sense. So those are the two major ideas that were pushing against each other, mm-hmm. Especially about a year after the, you know, probably 2021. Yeah. I don't know how much this was covered in Canada, but there was all these protests at school board meetings
yeah.
about CRT, and there's legislation being proposed and things of this nature. So you got a really big pushback, and that pushback, the argument, the pushback was, why are you bringing up race? If we just treat each other fair and equally, all the problems go away. Mm-hmm. So those are the two major ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. While we're talking about definitions, do you have a working definition of race? Of how you think about race? Mm-hmm. That's a really good question.
Easy question.
Well, the way I define my class mm-hmm. is race is a social construction. And what I mean by that is race is what society defines what race is. So I'm looking at you and you say you're from Syria. Mm-hmm. You know, if I just looked at you, you know, I would think you're white.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
yeah.
You're from Syria. So when you told me from Syria, I think, okay, so she's probably has some Middle Eastern in her.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Depending on how I define race, you are white or yes. you're not white because you're Middle Eastern.
Yes.
And in different places around the world, it'd be defined different ways.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, you know, and throughout our history, it's defined different ways.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there is a sense where race is a biological fiction. However, depending on where you're at in the world, whether you're defined as white and Middle Eastern would impact what you experience.
Sure.
So while it's a biological fiction, it's a social reality.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So that's the way to think about race.
Yeah.
That you know, when people say, well, there's only one in the human race, I say, okay, well, that's a good philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And biologically, you're correct in a certain sense. But sociologically, that's a myth.
Right.
You know, sociologically,
yeah.
how we define race has an impact mm-hmm. in our lives.
Yeah.
That is very, very interesting, especially for me understanding my own experiences in Canada.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When, like, for example, the people that already know that I'm from the Middle East treat me slightly differently than the people that have just met me and they don't hear an accent
uh-huh.
and, you know, versus or the time where I had
I hear a
thick
Canadian accent. So
yeah. I learned. Yeah. My husband is a Canadian too. But Canadian accent. Or when I had a thick Middle Eastern accent versus now that I lost my accent, there's a difference.
Yeah.
And I couldn't pinpoint it, but this explains it a lot. It's mm-hmm. how people perceive you and how they define race in their mind or what it means when they say a person belongs to this race.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it's very interesting.
And one of the things, it's good in terms of thinking about the Canadian context and then thinking that the podcast and the region audience is a global audience as well.
Yes.
You sort of raised this last night. The conversation in the States is the black-white, more mm-hmm. of the black-white yes. conversation. Mm-hmm. In some of our conversations at Regent, we've been talking about, well, who's marginalized in the Middle East racially is different to who's marginalized in Ghana, mm-hmm. who's different who's marginalized in Singapore, mm-hmm. who's different who's marginalized in Canada. So just the importance of kind of thinking as you like using that category, right. The explanations that you've got, but then contextualizing where we are globally as to who's who what conversations are happening between who. Yeah. If that, yeah.
Yeah, it can even get more wild than that.
Yeah.
Because, all right, so, you know, right now what's on everyone's mind is Israelis and Palestinians.
Right.
Yes.
Now we're thinking of that as a religious conflict.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a sense where it is a racial conflict as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because they're defining themselves as biologically different from one another.
Right.
Sure.
And when you do that, there's a racial conflict. Even if, you know, ethnically, they come from the same region, from uh-huh. the same,
yep.
you know,
yep.
genealogy, all that sort of stuff. The Hutus and the Tutsis.
Mm-hmm.
When that conflict happened,
yeah.
you know, the Africans were killing each other, and we would look at them and go, "Oh, they're both black," but they define themselves yeah. as biologically
yeah.
different,
yeah.
And they would point to, you know, we used to do this mm-hmm. with the Irish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the United States, the yeah. Irish were defined as not white, and people would say, "Well, they're not white. You know, they have this red hair, and they have this, and they have that." And so we figure out ways we can define our people are biologically different, but it's really not about the biology.
Mm-hmm.
It's about our social desire to define certain mm-hmm. groups as different from others.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really helpful. Thanks. So in terms of those two categories of people, and again, it's not that we want to categorize people, but so that people who would be thinking in the colorblind kind
yes.
of mm-hmm. way of thinking or the anti-racist kind of groups, who would kind of lean, if you can say, who would be in the colorblind
sure.
kind of group, who would be in the anti-racist group?
Yeah,
talk to us about that.
So, you know, in the United States, the you know, there's probably two major divisions. That's race and political ideology.
Yeah,
that whites are going to be more likely to adopt a more colorblind perspective,
mm-hmm.
And yeah. political conservatives are more likely to
yeah.
adopt a colorblind perspective.
Yeah.
On the other hand, people of color are more likely to adopt an anti-racism perspective,
mm-hmm.
and political progressives are more likely to have an anti-racism mm-hmm. perspective. Now, having said that, understand that obviously there are whites who are anti-racist, there are conservatives who are anti-racist,
yeah.
there are progressives who are colorblind,
mm-hmm.
there are people of color who are colorblind, and there's a probably about half the country that's kind of in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
That's really not strongly one way or the other. They may slightly lean, but they're not really strong about it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they may make up all different types of groups.
Mm-hmm.
But that's sort of how it's broken down in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really helpful. And so what are the sort of, mm-hmm. what would you say then the benefits or the downsides on both sides of those mm-hmm. ways of thinking?
Sure. So now I'll start with the colorblind first.
Yeah.
And let me just say that, you know, that I am colorblind sometimes, and I'm anti-racist.
No, I was going to say, where do you land?
Yeah.
Where?
Yeah.
Well, I'm never going away. What I'm saying is that contextual, there are times where colorblindness is, I'm a professor.
Yeah.
I'm colorblind when it comes to grading my papers. I'm colorblind when it comes to assessing grades.
Mm.
You know, mm. And I realized this probably about a month ago, in my interpersonal relationships, I tend to be colorblind. So if I meet someone, you know, I strive to not judge them based on what my perception of their race is mm-hmm. until I get to know them better.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that's a healthy way. When I was single, I was colorblind who I wanted to date.
Mm.
You know,
right.
That's sort of my attitude.
Mm-hmm.
So in my interpersonal relations, I tend to be colorblind. The problem comes when we try to use colorblindness to solve societal problems. Because,
mm-hmm.
you know, as I showed last night, we have a historical effect, institutional effect, and even modern racist attitudes.
Mm-hmm.
Those don't go away by ignoring them.
Yeah.
You know, if you have a wound, you don't, you know, you have to treat the wound
mm-hmm.
or else it just gets worse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, y'all, you know, I told you my kid is sick. He had strep throat.
Mm-hmm.
We need antibiotics in order to treat it. If we just let it go, then it'll just get worse.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem with colorblindness is it says, well, these problems, it has to sweep these problems under the rug. Like they really don't exist. They really don't exist. Let's just ignore it all
mm-hmm.
and treat each other equally. And as I just admitted, on a personal level, that's what I strive to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I strive to treat everyone well. As a Christian, I feel, you know, everyone is an image of God.
Mm-hmm.
And so I try to treat people in that way. I don't always succeed, but I try.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to solving social problems, it's not effective in doing
no,
that.
No, yeah.
Sometimes I'm anti-racist. Anti-racism does a very good job in diagnosing where problems lie.
Yeah.
You know, because it's looking for, you know, how racism impact these problems. Sometimes it helps us to see things that we may miss.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I put on my critical gaze, oftentimes it's an anti-racism gaze.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's good. So I would say anti-racism is good at finding problems. It's lousy at finding solutions. And, you know, I'm going to show this show tonight that a lot of the techniques anti-racism push, when we actually use them, either don't make much of a change or make things worse. And I think part of it is that one tenet that it's the that the purpose of whites is to do what people of color want them to do. And that sounds great if you're searching for justice and you look at what's happened historically.
Yeah.
But here's the problem. We humans, no matter what our race, are not well designed to have people do whatever we want them to do.
Yeah.
We tend to misuse that, to put it politely.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we see some of that. And so that becomes a problem, using anti-racism as a solution. Mm-hmm. Using it to find problems, I think, is great. Its solutions, though, are quite lacking.
Yeah. Okay.
Interesting. Yeah. Now, all people are touched one way or another by race and racial issues. But why should we as Christians specifically be interested in matters of race? Because some Christians would say that this racial issues and stuff isn't really talked about in the Bible.
Yeah.
It's not discussed, or
sure,
it's not really, you know, after Jesus and we're saved, then why care about these things? So does the Bible talk about race?
Well, all right. So they're right in this sense. The Bible doesn't talk about race the way we talk about race today, because the way we talk about race today didn't exist back then.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's just acknowledge that, that, you know, I can go into how race emerged around the 1400s, 1500s, the transatlantic slave trade. Didn't exist back in Bible times.
Okay.
Bible talks a lot about how we treat each other, though, and how we treat the Samaritans.
Yeah.
And we don't, here in 2024, Samaritans doesn't mean anything to us, okay? Because, all right, yeah, that's a group back in the Bible. The Samaritans were the group that the Jews hated with passion.
Mm-hmm.
And you can even argue that the Samaritans were of the different race of the Jews. Sometimes the Samaritans were hated because they're considered like kind of a half-breed.
Yeah, mixed blood, yeah.
And so how does Jesus treat the Samaritans? He tells a parable where they are the heroes. The parable of the man who was beaten, and the Pharisee walked up by him, and I think religious teacher walked by him, and then the Samaritan takes care of him. Woman the well was a Samaritan.
Mm-hmm.
He went through Samaria intentionally to minister to the Samaritans. So the Bible is, and you know, that's just one example. The Bible is talking constantly about how we treat others, how we're to love others as much or more than we love ourselves. So when it comes to relating to each other, the Bible is a source book on how we should treat each other.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is it a core requirement for salvation? I would agree that, yeah, you know, if we're talking about strictly about, you know, the need for salvation, it's not about race. But then Christians often talk about issues that are not, I mean, there's a big push for pro-lifeism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, can you be a racist and a Christian? Well, yeah. Can you support abortion being a Christian? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if we're talking about just the core, if that's all we ever talked about, then that's one thing. But that's not where we stay, and nor should we. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't talk about abortion or shouldn't talk about family structure, or shouldn't talk about, you know, how we treat immigrants or those sorts of things. I'm saying we should talk about those things and acknowledge that they're not the inner core of our Christian faith. But our Christian faith impacts those things.
Yes.
And therefore, we should talk about them. We should deal with them. We should see whether or not our faith has solutions that's missed by the rest of the world.
Yeah, I guess it also depends on what a person understands a Christian to be.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, for some, in some traditions, if the life doesn't reflect, then we're not a Christian.
Right.
So that might matter how you treat your neighbor, how Yeah, so it depends, I guess. Yeah,
So you think Christians do have something to say?
I think Christians have something to say. Yes.
About the conversation, and tell us a little bit about what you think the kind of the alternative. What's the unifying alternative that you're speaking about to colorblindness and anti-racism?
Okay, so I'll go into this much more in depth tonight, but I think there's a couple of principles our Christian faith gives us to think about this. I think one is human depravity.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's the source of our racial conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And human depravity is no respecter of race. You know, in other words, you'll find human depravity across the racial groups. It'll manifest itself differently. I'm not saying it's going to be, you know, that the type of manifestations of it's going to be the same.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I hope no Christian would say, well, my race is free of human depravity.
Mm-hmm.
And the other concept I think is very important is, you know, that we are to treat others, you know, as well or better than we treat ourselves. We are to love others. We see others as image bearers and treat them accordingly.
Mm-hmm.
And when you put that together, then how we approach this racial issue? And obviously there might, maybe not obviously, but there might be other ways. But the way I look at it is, okay, if I have human depravity within me, and I believe that discussion of human depravity always start within ourselves because it's easy to find it in others.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you need to start with yourself. So I have human depravity in me. Then what I need to do is humbly go before others and try to work with them to find solutions because they may see problems in what I'm saying and I can see problems in what they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I come at it very defensive and I'm going to attack and I'm going to get my way no matter what, then I'm not going to see how the depravity has corrupted me to where I'm no longer loving them the way God wants me to love them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If they're the same way, they're defensive and they're attacking no matter what. Mm-hmm. Same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So part of it, you know, so that's the sort of the Christian basis for what I would call a collaborative conversation that has to take place.
Mm-hmm.
We have to have better conversations on how we solve racial problems. And I'm not talking about, hey, can we just love each other and hold hands, walk sunset, sing kumbaya. And, well, that's great. That could be a part that happens.
Mm-hmm.
But before we get there, we have a lot of hard work to do.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
We have to discuss very real issues, hear people out in a very real way, and strive for solutions that try to meet multiple needs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Instead of, this is my solution, take it or leave it. Mm-hmm. And if you don't take it, then I'm going to force it on you.
Right.
Because that doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of what I would say, and I'll flesh it out more tonight, but that's part of what I would say is a Christian solution.
Yeah, it's collaborative conversations. Yeah. Have you had pushback on that from... on that as a solution from either side?
Of course, both sides.
What's been the pushback?
Yeah. Oh, let me correct. I'm going to go to the solution tomorrow night. Tonight I'm going to do the critique.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, yeah. The pushback is probably what you would expect. So a person with colorblind, their pushback is, why are you even discussing race?
Mm-hmm.
You
know,
right.
Why are you even bringing up race? If we stop bringing up race, because in their minds, bringing up race is the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've had people say, well, you know, all you do is talk about race, which is kind of funny because I talk about a lot of things.
Yeah.
But all you do is talk about race. Because I'll give you an example. It was 2020, when it became clear that Joe Biden was going to become the Democrat nominee.
Mm-hmm.
I said, okay, well, our next president's going to be old, white, and male.
Mm-hmm.
And what was funny is I had a lot of people come and say, there you go. You're not my race again. I said, old, white, and male.
Mm-hmm.
And no one commented that I was commenting on the age or the sex, but just the racial part.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, I was just making an observation. I didn't even say, you know, and, you know, these guys are horrible or anything. I just said, look, you know, our next president's going to be old, white, and male. And I wasn't even saying that you know, we just had a black president. So I wasn't saying that blacks couldn't be. I was just saying, look, you know, it comes down to this. This is your choices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so just because I said white, some people were sort of angered at that and said, why are you bringing up race? Why are you bringing up race? And so that's what I get from the colorblindness. From the anti-racism, I get a couple of pushbacks. One is that the argument that we can't expect people of color to enter into this conversation because of so much pain that's going on.
Yeah.
So I get that pushback. And another pushback. So let me deal with that one, because I think that one people will resonate more. The other one I think is weaker. Mm-hmm. I understand pain people of color have gone through. But at some point, when someone's in pain, for them to heal, you know, you can't leave them in that pain and angry or hurting. Mm-hmm. They have to engage in their own healing by engaging in the conversation with others. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not productive to protect people so much that they never have to say anything. Mm-hmm. You know, we're gonna fight for you. You just go and we're gonna fight for you. Mm-hmm. You know, it really is a kind of ironic, because same people would protest against the white savior mentality in mm-hmm. movies, and yet that is kind of exactly what they're doing.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
And so if you leave a person that way, that's not healthy. Mm-hmm. That's not healthy. And to be honest, we need to articulate ourselves what our, you know, we can't let others do that and then be upset when they don't articulate how we feel in the proper way.
Right.
It's a responsibility. It's a step of growth. Mm-hmm. Now, if someone had just experienced a horrible racial event, yes, you know, there may be a period of time where they're not able to articulate. But really, that's not the case for most people of color. Mm-hmm. They may face racism, but they're not in a situation where they're so traumatized that they can't articulate.
Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, that's not helpful ultimately in the long term. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The other comment that I sometimes get is I'm too nice to white people, which I always kind of funny. I think I know where they're coming from, and I think they're wrong. You know, anyone who takes my class know that I'm honest, but I will not dehumanize people in talking with them. Mm. And I do feel that some of the way people talk to whites is dehumanizing. Mm. And it turns off the conversation, understandably so. You know, if I feel people don't care about me, I'm less likely to hear them out. Mm. And so some of the rhetoric is dehumanizing. And if that's what I need to do in order to be down with the crew and not be too nice to white people, then that's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. So that's some of the pushback where I get it.
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks so much for mm-hmm. fleshing those out.
Yeah. That's very interesting. So how, then would you, implement, or how does this productive dialogue look like in churches and communities? How would you implement something like that?
So I think part of it is we have to learn in our society how to have a better life. I think we have to train ourselves.
Yeah.
Because I don't think we are used to it. We're either in silos, or everyone agrees with us, or when someone doesn't agree with us, we immediately go to the attack.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think we have to. And so one of the things I'm working on right now is trying to learn how to train people to have better dialogue, mm-hmm. and then try to document that empirically. Because uh-huh. I hope maybe in 4 or 5 years to write a book or have articles. Okay, here's what we did.
Okay.
And here's the result uh-huh. of this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know. And so we're still in some of the beginning stages. I do have a research team I'm working with.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We've worked with a couple of Christian schools, high schools, and we're learning. Mm-hmm. Our numbers are not high enough to where we can really document anything, but we're learning. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of where we want to push forward at this point in time. Mm-hmm. I have worked with some churches as well, mm-hmm. and I'm willing to work with other churches. Once again, learning how to train and to see what this dialogue looks mm-hmm. like and mm-hmm. to see how we can solve solutions that way. Mm-hmm. And I'm willing to work with non-Christian entities as well, mm-hmm. if they're interested in it.
Yeah.
You know, I almost work with the business, and that's sort of fell through.
Yeah.
So I want to learn how to do that so that we can have productive dialogue and what it looks like. I know some of the principles that people should use, mm-hmm. but how to train people to use those principles and put them in a situation where they can learn how to use them.
Yeah.
Part of what we're learning right now.
Are there any little themes emerging yet so far? I recognize that it's an on the journey. You're in the mm-hmm. process. Are there any sort of key things that are standing out that really is not working, or that's really working and that seems to resonate in a bunch of different spaces?
Yeah, I think one of the challenges we have is to bring all parties to the table.
Yeah.
Mm. One thing that's happened since George Floyd is that a lot of the more conservative elements have pulled back from the racial dialogue. And it's hard to get them involved in the conversation.
Mm.
It's because I don't want these dialogues to be people who already agree with one another. You know, they could be people who disagree with them. So that's been it. We also, one of the things that we've learned is that we set people up in small groups and have people lead the groups. Mm-hmm. And at first, we really didn't train the leaders very well. Mm. You know, we said, hey, here's what to do. And just, or we even said, hey, why don't you people take turns leading? Well, and we should have seen this coming. Different people have different capacities to lead small discussions.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know, just like anything else. You know, some people are very good at it, and some people are not so good at it. And so we need to train the leaders. And so so those are some things we're learning.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that's really helpful. Mm.
Yeah. Are there any thoughts that you would like to add to the conversation? Anything that you would like the, yeah, people who are interested to pay attention to? Mm. Or take with them?
Well, what I'll say is that this is going to be a long-term issue. You know, I've resigned myself to the fact that I'm not going to live long enough to see the fruition of a change towards this. I hope my sons will. Mm-hmm. So I sort of resigned myself to that fact because, you know, we've been this polarized for so long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
to
sure.
break that, mm-hmm. It's going to take a long time and it's going to take a lot of effort mm-hmm. In order to do that. So I would say that, you know, people who really want to engage in this, you know, just understand this is not going to happen overnight.
Mm-hmm.
Those who are interested in engaging in it, you know, I have some resources out there. They can learn more about it.
Mm-hmm.
I'll also recommend some books. Isaac Adams has a good book, Speaking of Race, mm-hmm. for pastors. I'm trying to remember the ex-football player. Now his name escapes me. Now I can't remember his name. Sorry.
That's right. No, that's right.
Yeah.
I can't think of his name.
There's a couple other books out mm-hmm. there that are very useful.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that you know, it's a long-term project. We got to work at better conversations. Mm-hmm. We got to learn how to do it. And we got to encourage,
mm-hmm.
And hopefully build a more of a community of people who engage in collaborative conversations rather than just lash out
mm-hmm.
at each other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, in terms of you saying you're working with churches and mm-hmm. you've been working with yeah. other businesses and stuff, have you been having conversations, or have you witnessed or been paying attention to other people who are having conversations around race in theological institutions and mm-hmm. theological education and some of the dynamics of that, and how that's obviously it's an educational space,
mm-hmm.
but it's also a Christian space. So it's,
yeah.
Do you have any, how's that going there? What are you seeing yeah. that's working, not working? What would you want to say to theological institutions and theological sure. education around these questions?
So I'm not a theologian, and so I'm not going to pretend that I,
that's all right.
that I've mastered
neither
it.
Are we.
You know, sometimes theologists talk about sociological issues like, oh boy,
yeah, you're like, yeah, stay in your lane.
So I do try to put some theology in this mm-hmm. in my book. Mm-hmm. You know, I do make a theological argument as well as an empirical argument because I want some Christians to hang on. And
yeah.
I would be interested in theologians taking that up
yeah.
and saying, and you know, saying either, no, you're off on this,
mm-hmm.
your theological interpretation is off, or yeah, this is a good way of thinking
right.
about it.
Yeah.
And let's develop this more.
Yeah.
My fear is a lot of times when in I have gone to a couple of theological institutions I think are open towards
yeah.
heading in this direction.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And think about it. They've invited me to speak, and okay. I've been happy to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times when we get into the popular realm, and when theologians speak on these issues, they fall quickly back on their political biases.
Mm.
So those from the left tend to talk about racial issues and develop a theology that supports anti-racism. Those from the right tends to develop theology that supports colorblindness.
Mm-hmm.
I fear that happens too mm-hmm. often.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than, in my opinion, letting the Bible speak for itself.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think the Bible speaks for itself, and we look at the principles that I outlined,
mm-hmm.
That then my solution makes sense. In light. The Bible does not say collaborative conversation is the way,
no,
per
yep.
se, and I, mm-hmm. I acknowledge that. But I think, you know, what's the implication of that?
Mm-hmm.
Of that? And I think that it is a way in which Christianity is different from a more secular mindset,
mm-hmm.
in that human depravity really differentiates us.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just put it this way. Why do humans have value? If you look at a humanistic secular mindset, humans have value because we've evolved and we're the highest pinnacle of evolution, and that gives us value in and of itself. So this human framework says, yes, humans are valuable. But what it doesn't say is humans have depravity. And so what's developed is this notion of perfectibility.
Mm-hmm.
There's all sorts of interesting implications. I mean, if I was if reincarnation was true and I came back as a theologian, I'd be all over that. You know, I think there's, I think that is an understudied, underutilized difference between Christians and humanists. Mm-hmm. That perfectibility. Also, and one of the implications is that if you don't do my solutions, be it colorblindness or anti-racism, you're not reaching perfectibility. And so everyone has to follow my solution. Depravity, you know, we Christians, humans are valuable because we're image bearers. Mm-hmm. It's not because we've evolved or that we've done all these great things, but we're image bearers.
Yeah.
And we have depravity. And that creates a different type of lane for how we understand our society, how we understand racial issues.
Yeah.
And that's not, obviously it's not limited to just racial issues. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's all sorts of implications of that. But I think that that is a critical theological direction.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, it was, you know, I've not dived into theology, and so I don't know if anyone's really dealing with that
mm-hmm.
particular
right.
dynamic. But it would be interesting to see mm-hmm. theologians deal with that.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah, no, that's really helpful. Dr. Yanser, is there anything more you'd like to say to us before you go? Like, just one, any little zingers you want to leave us to? It's like, I've been,
no,
you know.
I think it's been pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for accepting our invitation and mm-hmm. being with us and all the things we're learning from you.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're
looking
so happy
to the, the rest of the lectures. Right. Thanks for being with us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you. Friends, we hope that you enjoyed this podcast with Dr. George Yancey and that it's giving you some new ideas and new thoughts to ponder about race. And we hope you benefited from it. If you would like to learn more from our guest, then we would love you to leave us a review and rate the podcast through your podcast platform. And if you would like to leave us a donation by heading to rgnt.org/give. And you can also subscribe to the Regent News to hear more about the lectures, like today's lectures and new courses and podcasts, then please go to rgnt.net/subscribe. Thank you for listening.